Welcome to the Minivate Gang podcast for Saturday, November 15th, 2008. Welcome back, and today we have a very special guest. We're pleased to have with us Mike O'Connor. Mike, how you doing?
Just fine. It's great to be here.
Excellent. You're a self-described community organizer, now that that word can't be destroyed anymore, those two words. Entrepreneur and tech geek turned business leader, and I might add, going to your haven2.com site, seeing that you're not really a gentleman farmer, but turning those 420 acres back to native prairie and stuff, which is just a cool project.
Yeah, now I drive a giant pickup truck that gets 20 miles to the gallon with a bumper sticker on the back that says, "This truck is carbon offset," because all of the good things we're doing here at the farm. So I drive my giant truck with no guilt.
I was just going to say you're guilt-free then. Okay. All right.
Yeah, guilt-free zone here.
All right. It's very well, and then you also became sort of famous here in Minnesota as a guy that really jumped on the internet in the mid-90s. And in fact, that's how I first got to know you, is when I signed up with your ISP that you and your gang of cohorts built in St. Paul, GoFast.net. And I took on ISDN, I think in 93. Is that right? 93?
No, not that early. 95? We started GoFast in the beginning of 95.
Okay, so it had to be 95 then. All right. Okay.
Yeah, and I think you were in the first gang when it was still in the basement of my house, and it was really just Ralph and me doing that. Oh,
I didn't know it was in your basement. Anything. All right.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it was a big selling point for one of our corporate customers. They were so entranced because it was in the basement, and I would drag him down there, and I'd turn off all the lights and let him look at the blinking lights and stuff.
Oh, how funny. Cool. How funny. Well, and then you were such a rabble rouser with ISDN and a burr under the saddle of US West, now Quest. And that, obviously got you on a lot of people's radar screen. You know what I didn't know, though? And when I read your finance post about you having a bachelor's degree in economics, and I knew you had an MBA, I think from Cornell, but I didn't know that. And then you've sold domain names that you, I love your, "I'd rather be lucky than smart" comment.
Yeah.
About being able to sell those domains.
You have a choice in life between being lucky and being really smart. Take lucky, for sure. Yeah.
And then also on with us is Tim Elliott. Tim, how you doing this morning?
Hey, real good.
Excellent. And Graham Thickens.
Good morning from Bloomington.
Oh, you're not traveling again. All right, great.
I'm actually home.
Excellent. <Yep. laughs> Excellent. Well, I wanted to just start off maybe with kind of a first question overview about broadband in Minnesota. You know, we've been writing about it, and I've been following the Blandon on Broadband initiative quite a bit. And then when this Minnesota Ultra High Speed Task Force was set up, and lo and behold, there's Mike O'Connor on it. I would love it if you could just kind of give an overview, kind of a snapshot of what is the task force and what are you guys trying to accomplish? What's your maybe commentary on the state of broadband in Minnesota?
Well, I have to be a little careful because I am a member of that task force now. And so I have to do all the caveats that say, these are my opinions, not those of the task force, blah, blah, blah. It's pretty early yet. But let me give you a little history. I think it really goes back a few years to when Bill Coleman and I were doing a project with the city of Eagan to sort of map out the broadband future for Eagan. And we had this amazing task force that Tom Garrison, who's the communications director in Eagan, put together for us. And one of the things that he did was pull in the CIOs of some of the big companies that are based in Eagan, including a guy named Rick King, who's was the CIO and is now the COO of Thomson Reuters, which is based in Eagan, has a huge data center there. And what we did in that task force was sort of the standard, where are we at, where are we trying to get, study. And usual sorts of things, we discovered that there were substantial parts of Eagan that were underserved and not served at all by either cable or dial-up DSL type broadband. And that sort of got Rick and Tom and the city council and a bunch of folks down in that part of town sort of fired up about the state of broadband. And now you have to sort of fast forward a year or two. Tom and Rick and a bunch of folks put together a group that they informally called the Gig Group. I wasn't a part of that group, because I was off being distracted with something else, and by that time I'd retired, and so I wasn't doing freelance gigs anymore. But the Gig Group really was aimed at trying to get the issue of broadband on the radar of the legislature and set a goal for broadband speeds statewide, and they're sort of informal. Target was a gigabit for everybody in the state would be a cool goal. But their main point was set a goal. Don't just sit idly by and let this stuff happen organically. Mobilize public and political will to sort of drive broadband forward in the state for the sort of usual reasons, economic development, quality of life, energy reduction, telecommuting, trip reduction, you name it. The sort of standard list of reasons why you would want to pay attention to that infrastructure. And they went to the legislature a year ago and didn't quite make it in terms of getting a bill passed, and they came back again in the last session and did get a bill passed this time that essentially commissioned the Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force for the state, with the goal for the task force of spending about 18 months and about a year from now, October, November of 2009, coming up with a report that goes to the governor that's actionable, that sort of lays out what these goals should be and lays out what we think the right things to do would be to get there, and talks about how it might get funded and so on and so forth. On this task force are the usual suspects, representatives from the various sectors of the economy. There's folks from higher ed and education, both rural and metro. I am the representative of urban users of broadband, and there's another fellow from up just north of Duluth who's representing rural broadband users. There's representatives of rural and urban phone companies, rural and urban cable companies, some wireless providers, business folks, you name it. Mm-hmm. There's about 25 people, I think, on the commission altogether, and three commissioners from state governor, commissioner of deed, commissioner of the CIO from the state, and I think the head of the commerce. I think those three commissioners are represented. So, we've got a pretty good gang. And we started really getting going sort of late summer. Started, I think, in July or August. And it's kind of like watching an arm wrestling match.
You wait for the point. Yeah,
there's no motion whatsoever right now, but there's actually quite a lot of pressure being brought on both sides, and we're basically kind of getting to know each other and sounding each other out. As you might expect, our positions are pretty well known in advance, and so it's dull to watch from the outside, but it's sort of a necessary process of sort of getting this giant plane off the runway, and it it's gaining speed each month. We ran into a peculiar wrinkle with the stupid state open meeting law, which drives me crazy. Here's a
what is that? You sort of have alluded to that on the blog, but what are those constraints?
It turns out that if you behave normally on the internet, i.e., you know, what would be the first thing you would do with a task force like this? You'd set up a listserv for all 25 members, and then let email correspondence flow between the members in between the meetings, so that the conversation could sort of continue, positions could evolve, and we could trade documents and all this kind of good stuff. Well, it turns out that under the open meeting law of the state of Minnesota, at least given the very conservative interpretation we got from the Department of Commerce's lawyer, that's considered a continuous meeting. And that's illegal under the open meeting law because, the goal of the open meeting law is that if you're a public body like we are, you're supposed to meet in public places and make your meetings available to the public and not meet in private. And the notion of exchanging emails between members of the committee is considered a violation of that law, at least according to the interpretation we got. The law was crafted long before the internet and certainly long before the web 2.0, 3.0 stuff that you guys are interested in. And so it's mildly ludicrous, but what it means is that we basically can't talk to each other very much except in these face-to-face meetings that we have every month, which...
So can I ask this? And I'm assuming there'd be audit trail aspects to this and security aspects to this and certification of identity and all that good stuff. But I'm wondering why there couldn't be a public forum of some kind, even if it was a threaded discussion forum, so that people could weigh in on topics. Or would that also be exclusionary to those that don't have internet access?
I don't know. The interpretation we got from the lawyers was really just, we don't understand it. Because we don't understand it, we don't want to advise you to do anything that we don't understand. And so they basically scotched email, public forums, the whole thing, and said, well, a public forum would be okay, but the only thing you can do with it really is use it for announcements from the committee, from the chair. And it would certainly be fine to have a public forum in which citizens gave input and weighed in on issues, but we, the committee members, can't reply.
Okay.
And so I think there is a forum, or at least the plan is to have a forum out on the ultra high speed broadband webpage.
The button there.
Yeah, is it there? And yep. I haven't actually dialed into what's going on in that forum to see if there's any activity at all. It's not a bit yet. Early.
Well, it's a blog. It's a blogspot.com address. So it's, the intent of this is, I'm assuming, is to put up a topic and then let people comment underneath it. So it's not a threaded discussion forum.
Yeah. Okay.
At least this is something, though. At least this is a start.
Yeah, and I think that what will happen is the grouchy ones on the committee, me and a few others, sort of whined about it, and we've gone back to the Department of Admin for another look at that to see if we can't loosen these constraints up just a little bit.
Yeah.
But until then, we're sort of playing by the rules. It's the sort of thing where we looked at each other and said, this definitely needs a law change, but we're not the right people to recommend it. We got to stay focused on broadband.
Right.
And not the, it's just an old law that needs to be updated to reflect the sort of the new realities of the internet and the fact that, you know, nowadays, I mean, we didn't even try, you know, bringing up stuff like Twitter, you know.
Yeah.
The poor little lawyer would have just fallen off his perch if we'd done that. So we stayed away from that one. So anyway, you know, we're getting there, but it's a little slow because we, you know, we only have these meetings once a month. They're quite long. They start at 9 a.m. and they go till 3 p.m, but they're still just once a month. So, you know, the interesting thing, and actually my rant of the day, is that we're in an interesting spot with the economic situation that the country's in that wasn't anticipated when this task force was formed. You know, the task force was written into law almost a year ago now. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the economy was fine. You know, we didn't have any of the stuff that's going on now. And I was doing a little rabble-rousing at the last meeting and saying, look, you know, at this point, we have a really peculiar economy. We have, in fact, Paul Krugman has a piece in today's New York Times about it that talks about how depression economics is exactly the opposite of normal economics. Depression economics, you sort of throw away the rule book about balanced budgets because consumers have dried up as a spending source, and thus businesses have dried up as a spending engine in the economy, and that really leaves the only way to inject money into the economy is for the federal government to run massive deficits. This is what Roosevelt did.
Yep.
in the early 30s. And you can sort of see that coalescing in Washington. You can see it coalescing in the opinion pages like Krugman's piece. This notion that we sort of have to bite the bullet and inject a bunch of money into the economy. That's a large stimulus from the feds. And Krugman threw out the number $600 billion in his piece today. I think that may be low because one of the things that he's overlooking or choosing to ignore is that we're already stimulating the economy with the Iraq War. And when we wind that war down, that's going to undo a stimulus.
Right.
And so we may actually need to stimulate even more. Well, if you take that, you know, I mean, now, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats go crazy, and we'll just leave that debate for the moment. And let's presume that a stimulus actually gets put together. One of the things that Obama is talking about is changing the power grid so that it's more bi-directional, and the reason he wants to do that is to allow more decentralized sources of energy like renewables. So, for example, here at the farm, the power infrastructure that comes to the farm is fine for delivering electricity to the farm because I don't need very much. But if I wanted to put a 1 megawatt wind turbine up on one of the hills, which I could do, there's no way to get the power away from here because the electric grid isn't strong enough. It's not big enough to carry that much electricity. And what Obama is basically proposing is that we revamp the electric grid in order to be able to accommodate distributed power generation like that. And my thought is that we do the same thing with broadband infrastructure. You know, there's this whole debate about fiber to the home and who's going to pay for it and when and all this good stuff. And my reaction is, well, if you took a look at the country and you said there's 100 million urban households and there's about 15 million rural households, and you do a little back of the envelope math in terms of how much money it would cost to drop fiber into every household in the country, it turns out the kind of prevailing numbers are $2,000 a household in urban places and $6,000 a household out in rural places. And when you do the arithmetic on that, you wind up with about $290 billion, which in this era of $700 billion bailouts for banks and $100+ billion bailouts for auto industries, et cetera, doesn't seem like that much money.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that makes the people on the committee that would just as soon not see big changes in the status quo quite edgy. But I think the time is right now to start lobbying for that, because I think that the die will be cast pretty early in the Obama administration as to whether or not this could happen. And I think it would be totally cool if we at least gave it a nudge. You know, I think if you actually did it, you'd probably be able to get the price tag down, because you'd get learning curve effects. You know, if you started wiring up tons and tons of houses, you'd learn cheaper ways to do it. And I really think that the price per household would drop from 2000 to something below that. Same deal with rural. And so, you know, one of the interesting things is that the timing of our creation is pretty neat. Most of the states that we've been looking at have already done essentially this same report. California, Kentucky, you know, we've got sort of all the other state reports, and we'll pretty liberally plagiarize from them, mm-hmm. I imagine. But they all finished before this economic crisis happened. And so we may have the opportunity to sort of raise this option, you know, not just for Minnesota, it'd have to be for the whole country. But, you know, I think that if I were choosing my two favorite things to use to stimulate the economy, I'd certainly use the power grid thing as a really good one, but also this notion of really, you know, going crazy on the broadband infrastructure is another
absolutely.
Thing that could put a lot of people to work and also, you know, clearly, you know, really transform the way we did stuff on the net.
Well, and I think you should, I think you should recommend to the task force, Mike, that we start a civilian broadband corps and hire a bunch of people to go lay fiber. Just dig those trenches and I'm kidding. Sorry. It was funny when it was in my head, but go ahead, Ted.
It could be like the WPA was.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
Well,
instead of building lodges in Yellowstone, they could be laying fiber optic cable.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that, you know, all kidding aside, we've sort of tipped over into, and this is the point that Krugman was making today, we've sort of tipped over into a different kind of economics. I mean, normally, this is, you know, massive stimulus by the feds is frowned upon. Even by the most liberal of economists, because it's inflationary. And you then have to, you know, worry about overheating the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But when you get a contraction like the one we're in now, where consumers all of a sudden stop spending pretty much altogether, I mean, Best Buy just came out with some pretty awful numbers. And there's this new word that Marcy and I laugh about every time we hear it called deleveraging, which is, you know, it's a new word and it's overused, but it's different than most of the other contractions that we've been in, because what people were doing for all this time was basically borrowing money and spending it to consume. And that borrowing spigot sort of got turned off when housing values declined. So all of a sudden, the rules are different. And I think this is the time for sort of sweeping thoughts, big ideas, and that's my big idea of the week, anyway.
Well, Mike, speaking of the power line system, is there any movement on putting broadband through the electrical grid?
Yeah, IBM just came out with an announcement last week about that. Technically, it sucks to put power and bits together. It lots of people have tried it and the results have just been kind of unsatisfactory. IBM is going to take another run at it, and the trouble is that you know, the stuff just doesn't work very well. It generates, if you don't do it right, it generates a heck of a lot of radio interference. So the ham radio community is all up in arms because when you spray bits across unshielded wire, like power lines, you're creating a sort of massive antenna system and broadcasting radio frequency stuff all over the place. The bits don't traverse transformers, so you have to wire around them. It's kludgy. People have tried it, and most of the trials have sort of fallen apart, or people have sort of tiptoed away from them because it's been too expensive or too hard to maintain. But, you know, if someone can come along with a better mousetrap that sort of overcomes the technical issues, it's certainly worth a try. The odds are that kind of system isn't going to have the kind of bandwidth that glass can provide, fiber can provide.
But what about the FCC white space ruling that just happened? And, you know, I don't know technically, because I haven't dug into it too much, how that compares with WiMAX, for example. I mean, are you also looking at developments like that and saying how could that potentially influence, you know, a rural footprint for wireless broadband? Or is it naturally limited? So again, we're back to glass and fiber optics.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat you are, Steve. I haven't read the stuff about the white space either.
Okay.
It's attractive because it's in a pretty, especially some of the lower channels, it's pretty low frequency stuff. And, you know, radio likes to go further the lower the frequency it is. And so a lot of the stuff that we use today, like Wi-Fi, suffers because it's pretty high frequency. And so it doesn't go very far and doesn't go through walls, and it certainly doesn't go around corners very well.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why things like the Minneapolis Wi-Fi deployment kind of sucks, because there's trees and hills, and you know the radio changes a lot when the leaves come out and when they go away, and so technically it's sort of a crummy band to put data in because it wasn't really designed for that. And so the white space is neat because if you take a look at the white space in the lower VHF channels, like channels 2 through, say, 10, you know, that's getting pretty low frequency stuff. It goes around corners, it goes over hills, it goes through trees. And so it's pretty appealing as a way to distribute data compared to Wi-Fi. And beyond that, I've pretty much shot my wad. I haven't read the... Okay. Read the stuff about that. But, you know, our conversation right now is focused on sort of who needs what. And the answer you get is it depends. You know, somebody who's in a hospital doing remote sensing of a patient or shipping an MRI off to a super doc somewhere in an urban center probably needs a whole lot more bandwidth than you know, somebody who's just checking their email or surfing the web. And what we're trying to do is sort of get our arms around what those tiers are, partly so that you can say, well, if you're in a county or a district that doesn't have a hospital, doesn't have a big company, you know, et cetera, whoever needs to occupy that top tier, you may not need as big a road into your district as a place that does. On the other hand, you get the chicken and egg problem. You say, well, yeah, but if I don't build the road into my district, then those folks will never move there. And so, you know, we have this sort of, oh, I don't know, at least 15-year-old debate between the carriers who say nobody ever buys this stuff, so thus they must not need it, And folks like me who say, we don't know what we need until we have it and invent the applications that are enabled by that super high bandwidth. I mean, this conversation we're having today over Skype wouldn't have worked over the ISDN line that you and I had, Steve, back right. in the old days. It's just not enough bandwidth. And so we never would have invented it because we wouldn't have had the capability to do it.
Well, and then if I could just interject real quick, and this is obviously near and dear to Minovate and to entrepreneurial activities and startups and so on. My favorite story about this in broadband was the interview that I did with Darren Cotter from Cotter Web, who was in a small town in southern Minnesota where he grew up and had a dial-up line. And his dad asked him for his 16th birthday, do you want a car? We can go get you a car for this price point. And he said, no, I want a computer. So he got a computer. And when he went to Mankato State and he got into the dorm room, he said, you know, all my buddies were out, you know, running around, going to parties and that. And I was sitting in my room because I had a broadband connection, you know, on the web, building stuff with open source software. And he ended up ultimately building Cotter Web, which is about a $12 million organization here and now in the cities. But I mean, there's one story that's probably my favorite of what happens when that pipe is there and you've got some young person that says, you know, what can I build? What can I do? And then goes out and does it. Right. So what sorts of things would, Matt, not just from a human connection and personal communication standpoint, but you know, the medical obviously is one of the keys about being able to have experts traverse geography by being connected. But you know, I think again about what a catalyst this could be for startups and for entrepreneurship.
Well, you know, you sort of look at any sector, entrepreneurial startup businesses, big businesses, small education, big education, you know, pick a sector. It doesn't matter. It turns out that there are compelling stories to tell in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have, in a way, this is like kabuki theater. You know, it's a very stylized dance that we're going through on this committee. It's a dance that's been danced dozens of times before. One of the drawbacks that I face is that the people on the carrier side who are defending the carrier's position and who I quite enjoy are people who are paid to be there. You know, that's their job. Their job is to go sit in seats at the legislature or in committees like this and make sure that the interests of their corporation are served.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the folks on the other side, the innovators, aren't. We're not paid to do this. I mean, you know, I'm a volunteer. I happen to be retired, so every day is a Saturday, and that's a good thing because, you know, it means that I can devote a lot of time to this. But, you know, the voices of innovation, for the most part, don't get heard as much as the voices of the carriers simply because the carriers are paid to be there. And so the dance is... The innovators come in and we talk about all this cool stuff that we could do and so on and so forth. And the carriers come back and say, well, yeah, but there's no money. And, who's going to pay for this? And they raise, of course, the specter of socialism. And then the Republicans get acne and, you know, start pounding the table. And pretty soon we're, you know, sort of dancing around saying, well, we need to make an environment that is attractive for investment by carriers. And pretty, you know, that's sort of code word for deregulation, which leads us down the path into the issues of net neutrality
mm-hmm.
and unregulated monopolies. And so another rant that I've been on for ages, which I actually stole from Dennis Fazio back when he and I were sitting in a hearing together.
And he's the MRNet founder, right?
Yeah, he's the founder of MRNet and now runs TIES, which is an ISP that serves higher education, education
K-12 also, don't they? The district. Okay.
Yeah, he's got a whole bunch of customers, I think, all across the state. Anyway, he's way smarter about this stuff than me. And one of the things that he pointed out, and which I sort of elaborated on, is that the internet comes in layers. And if you get real geeky, there's like 6 or 7 layers in this International Standards Organization model. But I always sort of simplify it to 3 because that's all I can get my arms around. There's at the bottom, there's the physical layer. There's the actual physical thing that connects you to the network, copper, fiber, radio, whatever. In the middle is what I kind of lump together. I lump a bunch of layers together and call them the internet layer. That's the layer of the network that sort of makes sure that the packets get from where they're supposed to originate from to where they're supposed to go. And then at the very top is the application layer. And my premise is that you have to regulate those layers differently because at the bottom, that's a natural monopoly. You don't see 5 electric companies coming into your house competing for your electric business. You see one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's, you know, it's a natural monopoly, which means that it's always cheaper for a monopoly provider to do that than a competing provider to do it. And in general, if you leave them alone, monopolies emerge. My position is that if you have a natural monopoly, then you need to regulate its behavior. Now, at the other end, on the top, on the application layer, that's the exact opposite. There, if, you know, Cotter Webb wants to come on and Mikey Webb wants to come on and Stevie Webb wants to come on, there's nothing, there's no barrier for us to put a new application on top of the network. And so that doesn't need to be regulated at all. And in the middle, it needs a kind of medium amount of regulation. It doesn't have to be a single monopoly because it's not a natural monopoly, but it still needs some rules of the road. And that's why I spend so much time at ICANN meetings. I just got back from Cairo, the ICANN meetings there, because in that middle layer, there is a need for some regulation. Well, the carriers hate this idea. What the carriers want to do is they want to integrate all 3 layers. They want to deliver content to you over their managed network across their physical layer. And so they've been very successfully lobbying for the last 8 years in this Republican environment that deregulation is a good thing. Just leave us alone. Let us invest. Let us make our rate of return. And we'll take good care of you. And my reaction to that is baloney. You know, essentially, in most places in urban Minnesota, at most you have 2 providers. You have a telco provider delivering some form of DSL, and you have a cable provider delivering some sort of DOCSIS-based services over the cable infrastructure, and that's it. And The old days when there were lots of independent ISPs like GoFast.net are pretty much gone because over the last 8 years or so, the FCC has basically ruled in favor of telephone companies and made it very difficult for anybody else to gain access to the network infrastructure of the phone company. And so you just don't see. I mean, you know, there's Visy and there's IP House and there are a few stalwarts that sort of hang on, but there's not very many anymore, and it's extremely difficult to enter. So you know, along with sort of an infrastructure push, another thing that I'm pretty keen on is the notion that it's especially the physical layer stuff and the low layer internet stuff should be regulated more like a utility than a free market good the way it is now. And one of the things that's very cool is that the folks who are taking a look at the FCC on the transition team, for the most part, come from the net neutrality community and the community that's saying, look, you know, you really need to regulate the internet as a utility rather than as an information service, which is essentially a 180 degree shift from the way the bias has been for the last 8 years. So, for example, Susan Crawford, who's a person who was on the ICANN board, she just got off the ICANN board a couple of weeks ago in Cairo, is really articulate about all this stuff. She started OneNet Day, and she just got named to the Obama transition team that's taking a look at the FCC. And so my hope is that we'll see a different climate at the federal level that will, again, hopefully we at the state level can be ready to sort of catch the football when that happens and, you know, sort of rejigger our policies, which, you know, up to now have been pretty accommodating to the carriers. We sort of bend over backwards to make sure that the environment's good for them to invest. You know, we've deregulated a lot. We've taken a lot of the teeth out of the Commerce Commission's ability to do stuff. We are in the middle of unwinding the authority of cities to regulate cable. There's a push that was hard fought and lost last time in the legislature, but it's back again this year, talking about moving cable regulation from cities up to the state level. And the rationale is that it makes it easier for cable companies to deliver services because they have a uniform regulatory environment. But in the process, what we lose is all the activism, and we put it pretty squarely in the hands of the professional lobbyists that hang out at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm cranky about that too. And I'm hopeful that we'll see a pretty big regulatory change at the federal level, and that will swing down towards us, and then that this task force will be able to craft a set of policies that sort of dovetail with that new environment and push the ball forward out here in Minnesota. Okay.
Well, I'm curious because I've been following what the Blandin Foundation's been doing with Blandin on broadband for quite some time. I'm gonna be attending that conference that they have coming up at ADC Telecommunications in December. But how does what the task force is doing intersect with that Blandin initiative? Are they an advisor? Are they is there any interaction? Is there overlap with what they're doing?
Well, there's a little overlap because I sit on that Blandin board as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
And so I'm sort of the overlap.
Okay.
And, you know, Blandin's focus by charter is they're really interested in rural issues in Minnesota. They're proscribed from messing around in any of the urban areas. And that goes all the way back to the founding of the foundation and the way that the Blandins set that trust up. They are really interested in rural issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the years, Blandin got involved in broadband. I can't remember, a while ago, eight years ago, somewhere in there. Don't hold me to that, but it's been a while. And it's safe to say that part of the reason that this task force, this state task force exists, is because of the projects that Blandin has done, raising awareness of the issue, developing approaches to getting rural communities better served with broadband. And the Blandin policy line is much more moderate than mine. I mean, I am a, you know, just way out there on the edge kind of guy when it comes to a lot of these issues, whereas Blandin is much more pragmatic in terms of working with the existing carriers and trying to get them to step up to the plate in towns you know, my approach has been basically to put a stick in the carrier's eye, because I've been so frustrated with him for so long. Whereas, you know, what Blandon often will do is they will go into a town and sit down with the carriers and say, look, you know, the community really needs better broadband. How can we work together to get this to happen? And, you know, they've got a whole gaggle of projects that they've done across the state that have yielded, you know, pretty impressive results in terms of improving availability of broadband in the town. And also, one of the things that Blandon really focuses on is raising awareness as to using broadband. You know, they go in and do a lot of training sessions with folks in the town to explain how this all works and how they might use it in their business or in their personal life or whatever. And by doing that, the goal is to raise demand, which in turn raises the interest of the carriers to provide the facilities, because now they can see a cash flow. And so it's a much more cooperative view than the view that I've been espousing, which, you know, right now I'm in a frustrated with the carriers kind of frame of mind. But, you know, I think that the Blandon approach is probably a pretty good model for where we'll see the task force going, which is, you know, rather than my sort of super unrealistic, you know, out with all the rascals approach, we'll see some sort of hybrid where there are incentives provided for carriers to build stuff out. There are, ranging from things that make Rick King cranky, tax incentives, all the way to monetary incentives, awareness raising amongst a bunch of the corporations. Rick's company, Thompson West, was able to make a huge difference in Eagan once they were aware of the problem that Eagan had in terms of having whole swaths of Eagan not served by any broadband carriers, because Quest hadn't lit the DSL portion of a whole bunch of little switches in Eagan.
Oh, wow.
And Rick stepped up to the plate and said, well, I suppose that I could throw a contract at Quest if they, in exchange, agreed to light up those switches. And he sat down with John Stanek at Quest, and there was a smoke-filled room, and they emerged with a deal, and now Quest lit up all the switches in Central Eagan with DSL, and hopefully is enjoying the benefits of a multi-million dollar deal with Thompson. And, you know, I think that kind of approach, that sort of pragmatism, is probably what will prevail. You know, I'm going to sit way out on the extremes to be a counterweight to drive some regulation into that, because I am frustrated with, partly I'm frustrated with the unevenness of the regulation. You know, the telcos are quite regulated because they were once upon a time viewed as a natural monopoly, and so they've been regulated for decades. And the cable companies aren't regulated much at all. They would whine and say that they are, but compared to telephone companies, they're not. And Steve Kelly, who's a long-term member of the Minnesota legislature, now at the Humphrey Institute, and longtime student of this sort of regulatory problem, says something that I do agree with, which is that we need consistent regulation across those two infrastructures, because those two companies are starting to look identical. They're delivering the same stuff over different infrastructure, but really the only difference between them is at the bottom of the stack. One uses copper, and, you know, in the case of Verizon out east, it's not even copper anymore. Verizon's bringing fiber into everybody's house.
Yeah.
The cable companies are copper coax, and they're tending towards fiber, and yet they're regulated wildly differently. They're both delivering triple play. They're both delivering voice data video. And so, you know, I'm going to agree with Steve that we should have consistent regulation. I'm not going to agree with him. His approach was always to loosen regulation where possible in order to bring investment into the state. I'm not quite ready to make that deal with the devil just yet, because and there's where I think net neutrality is a good example of what happens when you completely let a free market prevail. The net neutrality debate is, the way I summarize it, is that there are some who feel that if you have a packet on the internet, it ought to be delivered without regard to its point of origin. So if you have a video packet that starts at your website and I have a video packet that starts at mine, the delivery to the end customer should be the same across the internet. So the internet is neutral. The opposite side says there are some packets that deserve better treatment than others, either because they pay more for the privilege of being delivered or because they are screwing up our network. And so the network shouldn't be neutral.
Well, can I interject, though, because, first off, I have to disclaim my bias for net neutrality. But at the same time, and again, I haven't dived deep enough into this issue to really form a real strong opinion, but because I also enjoy Comcast 5020 service at the office, which now that I have a taste of really good high speed broadband, I don't ever want to go back, but I want more. But what I think about is not packet discrimination, but what about volume of packets? So, the whole notion of, which I believe is a defensive move on the part of the cable companies to start to cap the amount of broadband, so that now that Apple TV and Hulu and YouTube and all these other providers are wanting to deliver better and higher quality video, that's going to really threaten that triple play, regardless of who delivers it.
Well, it won't threaten Comcast triple play, because of course their video will not be subject to the cap, right?
Correct. Yes. So yes.
So again, this is this problem where if you integrate all three layers, if you combine the physical layer with the internet layer and the content layer in one provider, you distort the way things are going to work, and it gives. It's just like voice over IP. Interestingly enough, the voice over IP that Comcast provides works a lot better than using Vonage on a Comcast connection. Again, because they're discriminating based on the origin of the packet. And that's where I think, that's a good example of where I think you cannot leave this to be an unregulated market.
Yeah.
Because what you do when you tinker in the middle layer, in the internet layer, and you favor your application over mine, that gives you an unfair advantage.
Well, so let me ask you this then, in terms of leapfrogging, because it's, potentially the white space FCC ruling might make an impact on deployments and so on. What about internet too? I know that Minnesota, I don't think, has a node, right?
Yeah, they do.
We do, right, directly on internet too? Isn't there like a backbone, and then there are separate nodes that are off the back of the backbone, and we're one of those off the backs, or?
Yeah, we're off the back. Okay. I don't think we're part of the core network, okay. But we're, Minnesota and a bunch of facilities in the state are connected to internet too.
Well, how is that going to play into this recommendation? Well, I mean, maybe it's too early for you to even talk about, but is that going to play a role in some way in terms of future strategy and direction relative to broadband?
Well, internet too is kind of like supercomputers. Internet too is always... the best definition of a supercomputer is the fastest computer you can make at any given point in time. So, you know, back in the 80s, a Cray was the fastest computer. Well, now, you know, shoot, your laptop will probably perform comparable to a Cray, but you'd never consider your laptop a supercomputer. You know, now you have to, you know, go way, way, way upscale to get there. And Internet 2 is sort of the same thing. Internet 2 will probably always be faster than the what they call the commodity Internet by definition, so that they can experiment with what the implications are for a very, very high speed, very robust, very reliable network that simply can't be delivered by the commodity Internet.
Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, they do things like, you know, they do medical procedures through this, I think. They either do medical procedures or they at least... I think they were doing stuff with robots where the surgeon was far away and the robot was mimicking the surgeon's moves and the command and control was delivered over the Internet 2 infrastructure.
Okay.
Well, you know, you can't have a glitch in that because, you know, the little robots, you know, in messing around in somebody's body, you can't be dropping packets on that. So, the Internet 2 is always unbelievably overbuilt compared to the way commodity Internet is built. And my presumption would be that when the commodity Internet gets up to the point where Internet 2 is now, that the Internet 2 will be, again, have moved on, sort of the way supercomputers move on. And so... you know, Steve Cawley and the folks at the U are on the task force, and they gave a presentation last time about what Internet 2 is and what it means and how it got organized. And we, you know, we'll certainly look at that as kind of a model. But it's unlikely that we would ever see us moving to Internet 2 because by definition, Internet 2 is exclusive.
Okay, got it. You know,
it's not a place that normal people can hang out, because if you let normal people hang out there, it would no longer be able to do the cool stuff that it does.
Okay. Well, we're bumping up against our hour, Mike O'Connor, and I don't know if anybody, Graham or Tim, if you have any other questions or anything, but this has been fabulous. I mean, I feel like I got a primer.
Yeah, I was going to say, Steve, that anything that Mike can do and with this committee to help further more competition for consumers with broadband choices, I'm 100% behind that.
Well, and you know, I think that the thing that we've always got to get back to is this layers thing. You know, I would really like to see, and this is way out there, nosebleed stuff. There's no way that this is going to happen anytime soon. And it's certainly not going to happen out of the task force. But if I were king, what I would do is say that the physical layer that comes to your house or your business or your hospital or your school or whatever is like roads or sewers. It's owned by us, the people, collectively through a government thing or a nonprofit, or I don't know. I mean, there's lots of examples like District Energy in St. Paul, which is a nonprofit that's not part of the government, but, you know, strongly enabled by the government. But, you know, it's a shared resource and it's built in such a way that people in the higher layers, in the internet layer, competitors in the internet layer and the application layer, can compete to get your business. I think as long as we continue with this model where the carrier owns the facilities, that the fallback position has to be, okay, if you want to own the facilities, then you have to be willing to be regulated. If we continue with unregulated carriers owning facilities into people's houses, and buildings, we're always going to be losing ground. You know, we've gone from whatever it was, third to 20th in terms of worldwide penetration of broadband in the last 8 years. And I think that's a legacy of this deregulated environment that we're in. So that's, you know, that's where I'm headed.
Hey, Mike, any activity with wireless broadband infrastructure like WiMAX in your committee talks?
We haven't gotten a whole lot into technology discussions. We have talked a bit about the issue of rural communities being hard to wire, and that wireless might be a way to reach them, but only in passing. We probably will not get so specific as to start recommending technologies per se. We're really about where do we want to be, hopefully setting a pretty aggressive goal in terms of speed, and how do we want to get there in terms of policy, funding, et cetera. But we probably won't talk much about the actual technology that's used to reach folks.
And one last question, is there quite a bit of dark fiber, particularly downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul, that could be also leveraged?
There are people who know that a lot better than me. There are a couple of folks who've sort of made a business out of knowing where that fiber is and putting deals together around that fiber. And they say that there's quite a lot, but I don't really know the answer on that one. It's haphazard, I think, at best. It's not an orderly affair. It's not a grid. It's not a pre-planned grid that says every street's got this kind of capacity. It's sort of where the fibers got pulled by various projects over different times by different carriers in different eras with different kinds of glass, blah, blah, blah. It's a hodgepodge. And there are a couple of folks in town whose names just escape me who are saying, come to me. I know where all the fiber is. I'll help you put a deal together to build whatever network you want to build. And the converse deal that they propose to the owners of the fiber is, come to me and let me sell capacity on your fiber, and I'll bring some cash flow to what is otherwise a dead asset for you. And, you know, it's a pretty good business model. And so I think that there are some areas, especially like you say, Tim, in the downtown areas where, you know, there's some pretty interesting things that can be done. But in terms of, you know, you get out into first, second, third tier suburbs, it gets pretty sketchy in terms of fiber in the ground these days.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thanks for carving out this time on a Saturday, especially. I know you keep saying...
Every day is a Saturday. So I'm just gonna, you know?
That's what I'm just going to say. All right.
It's a tough life, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Yeah, don't...
Pick a Saturday except Sunday.
Yeah, don't be rubbing our face in it all. All right. Hey, thanks much. Appreciate your time.
No worries.
All right.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks.
You bet.
Take care, guys.